TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Vandana Shiva, the future of food and farming in a pandemic world, part 2 of 2. If you were here last week on the radio or internet, you heard the beginning of a conversation between students from the Faculty of Land and Food Systems at the University of British Columbia and the Indian ecologist and former physicist Vandana Shiva. Before earning her PhD in quantum theory, Vandana Shiva had been training in India in the Atomic Energy Commission. She credits the CHIPCO movement, where she volunteered, with teaching her about biodiversity. CHIPCO was a nonviolent ecological movement in the 1970s, started by rural villagers, mainly women. They were protecting forests, slated for government-backed logging, by embracing the trees and stopping the chainsaws. Vandana Shiva gave up a career in physics and returned to her mother's farm. She set up the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology in her mother's cowshed in 1997, and she became an eloquent spokesperson for the ecological value of traditional farming. In this program, we're joining Vandana Shiva and the students at the University of British Columbia halfway through their masterclass on Zoom. She had just been asked, "Do you see a place for technology to support smallholder farmers rather than displacing them?" Vandana Shiva.
Like I said, I've lived through a period where there was a manual typewriter. It was seen as a technology which you used and chose, a computer. Each of these are technologies. And we should be choosing them. And we should be evolving them according to how much do they serve the earth and human well-being. It's only in the last 20 years that the vocabulary of technology has shifted from being about instruments and tools to being literally a master. Instead of saying technology to do what, with what impact, we just say technology, you gotta have technology. When I grow biodiversity of crops on my field, that's a technology of biological control. It's not violent, but it's still a tool. And I can spray pesticides. Interestingly, when I grow biodiversity, I'm actually more effective in controlling pests. There are no pests in our farm at Navdanya. And when I spray poisons, I have more and more pests. And when I do GMO BT cotton, I have more super pests. So I think, as I've written in my book, Oneness versus 1%, colonialism was about a civilizing mission. Indigenous people of Canada, anywhere in the world, know how we were brutalized, we were violated. Indigenous people of North America were exterminated for a civilizing mission. The civilizing mission then was colonialism and the religion, conversion. The civilizing mission today, I hear the rhetoric and I say, my God, this is a new civilizing mission. Things that should be chosen democratically. Things that should be evaluated democratically. The minute you take what some humans have made, and turn it into the religion for everyone to adopt, technology has lost its toolness. It's become an instrument of mastery. Stop using the term technology in abstract. You know, let's start always being concrete, saying it's a technology to do this and it has this impact. And we should never introduce technologies without assessing impacts. That's why we had environmental impact assessment. That's why we had technology impact assessments. This is part of what deregulation is doing just now. So we shouldn't talk of money and technology as absolutes and ends. We should talk of money and technology as means for higher ends. And for me, the higher ends are taking care of the earth and following the laws of Gaia and taking care of the well-being and the good for all. We can achieve that, yes, that's fine. bring whatever. But whichever tool undermines the earth's ecosystems, and whichever tool takes power away and livelihoods away from people, I think we have to have a democratic discussion in society. When I did my book on the Green Revolution, I went to the elders, the wise people in India. I said, you guys were the brilliant people of this country. Why didn't you have a debate at that time in the 60s? And they said it was introduced in the name of technology. And we were brought up as the generation which was told, you don't ask questions of technology. I said, well, that's like fundamentalist religion. You're not supposed to ask questions of fundamentalist religion. Otherwise, you're a heretic. So technology, you're supposed to debate and assess. We are literally in a period where the new civilizing mission is hit you on the. I've lived through my country being forced to adopt digital payments and made cash illegal in the middle of the night in 2016. 90% of the economy of people disappeared. Savings of a poor woman selling vegetables on the street went. So I really feel there has to be assessment, accountability, democratic choice.
I love that concept of democracy and democratic choice that you bring up, because I feel like the violence of the Green Revolution and everything we've seen is because we've lost that democracy, and because research and development has been driven by large multinational corporations who are interested in solely industrial agriculture. And I'm wondering how we can better democratize science and research and development to not only serve the interests of large multinational corporate agriculture, but perhaps other interests of nature-based solutions and protecting our planet and conserving our planet while also feeding the world.
So when I talked about my book on the violence of the Green Revolution, I did a lot of research. Where did these chemicals come from that killed people in Bhopal, got farmers into debt in Punjab? And I realized that actually they all came from Hitler's labs, IG Farben. IG Farben and Standard Oil jointly, fossil fuels and finance from Standard Oil and new chemicals, Xylon B, ammunition. The process for making ammunitions by burning fossil fuels at high temperature is the same process that makes synthetic fertilizers. The same factories make it. So whether it's fertilizers or pesticides, the ancestry is in Hitler's concentration camps. Who were the companies that kept pushing it to make it inputs into agriculture and changed our agriculture thinking through all kinds of pressures, including, I notice you're from Philippines originally, Alison, yes? IRI, the International Rice Research Institute, the CGIAR system, the Green Revolution in rice, that center had a very, very big role. So what we have seen in these last few years, I realize when you have too many names for the same phenomena, as a scientist, I say one name. So I say this chemical, that chemical, this pesticide, that pesticide. And my friends keep looking into the individual details of the Roundup and the dicamba and all. And I've just decided I'm going to call the companies that make them, which were the IG Farben, I'll call them the poison cartel. So how do we make them accountable? I held a tribunal on Monsanto. That is how you democratize. We organized people's assemblies, brought together. It was all fragmented, and the globalized system has been fascinating to watch. We were national countries in a UN system, and then globalization changed it. We became national politically. The economy became global. The players of the economy were global, and we were stuck in our national systems, each with our current amazing leaders. How do we deal with this? I used to go to Argentina, seeing the birth defects and cancers. I'd go to Brazil. I'd go to Canada, Percy Smyser. Sri Lanka, kidney failure. I said, we're going to bring all these cases together in one place. Say, here are all the crimes against nature and humanity. The following year, Monsanto was bought out by Bayer. So we have to mobilize in creative ways to bring accountability, especially where the formal system is being deregulated and dismantled. The second is we have to build alternatives. All of the work on agroecology has grown outside university systems, you know? But now universities are adopting them. Now the FAO talks about agroecology. The amazing science is emerging about the soil food web, about the insect web of life. I am absolutely excited about the future of science related to regenerating the earth rather than a science for killing life on earth, because those are the two sciences we can choose from.
Following from the conversation, so you are optimistic. I guess if you had the greatest scientists and engineers, developers, makers, what should we be asking? What should we be driving science and scientific discovery towards? Just to touch on your last point.
So Lenny, you know, I trained before I came to Canada. I was training in the Indian Atomic Energy Commission in the fast breeder reactor. My head was up there. I thought I knew more. Then I started to volunteer with the CHIPCO movement, where I realized I learned nothing about it, biodiversity. It's the women who've never been to school who are my teachers. So the first thing we have to learn is give up the white superiority syndrome of experts who know and others are fools. Everyone knows. Indigenous people are brilliant scientists. We've got to start respecting their knowledge of science. So the question I would pose to any kind of scientist from any discipline is, how do we grow food in ways that leaves the soil richer, the farmer better off, and the eater healthier? Simple question, multiple complex interactions, not a magic bullet solution.
Awesome, thanks for that. Let's pass it right over to Bruno.
Yeah, thanks, Amy, and thank you, Dr. Shiva. My question basically is, in a hypothetical world without large-scale agricultural technology, how can you or we guarantee that benefits to local farmers would translate into food availability, food affordability, and food safety for consumers both in their respective markets and society as a whole, especially in urban areas, concrete jungles such as Toronto, New York City, that we find all over the world?
So first, the concrete jungles have been created because the World Bank had decided that we don't need farmers. Everyone should be in the city because you can do more business in a city. And it was by conscious choice. People were driven off the land and cities became mega cities. I have watched in the pandemic how people who had left the villages because of the lockdown had to go back to the villages. Cities started to empty out. I was in Brazil during the Earth Summit. The Brazilians had been removed from the land. Kids caught and thrown out. And we came back, my son was with me, and he says, "Mama, why is it that our people can be free, and in Brazil they capture children?" And I had to explain to him how by choice we had kept small farms, created laws on making land distributed, had ensured that farmers got a decent return. Very complex set of systems, and it worked. So 75% of India stayed on the land. Only recently some left, but they're all going back. My basic vision is, why should we destroy the planet and the quality of our food by using energy slaves when more and more people want to take care of the earth? And with small farms, you know, when you talk small farms, it's like a garden. When you talk giant farms, it's like a war. We have to move from a war model of agriculture to a garden model of agriculture. When you ask me, how will you ensure enoughness, affordability, quality? Well, quality is guaranteed when you're consuming what is produced locally. You know the farmer who grew it for you. And I've just started a program in India called Swaasth. We know. Swaasth means both. We have the confidence, but it also means health. And we launched it this year, precisely to address this question. Do we need third-party certifiers who take 10 times more than the value of the produce is? No, you need community. So local community, Price-wise, like I said, the extractive economy leaves 1% for the farmer, and a speculative economy makes food prices go up. We shorten the distances between the eater and the consumer, and something that has happened during the lockdown, more and more CSAs were created, more and more local markets were created. The price becomes honest rather than that deceitful price. And third, on enoughness, as I mentioned, you start calculating differently. Instead of yield per acre, nutrition per acre, as we do, our data is showing we can feed 2 times India's population by not destroying a single aspect of life on Earth. By conserving biodiversity, you actually grow more food. You know, we do this, but we also do the measures. And part of my quantum theory training is what you measure is what you find. When you look for a wave, you'll find the wave. When you look for the particle, you'll find the particle. So none of the measures are independent of what you were looking for. If you're looking for a commodity, you'll create yield per acre. When you're looking for health, you'll create health per acre.
No, thank you very much. And I think as a world, we need to really focus on those supply chains and rethink the way that they are structured in order to benefit the greater society and the world that we live in. So thank you very much for your time.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for that question, Bruno. But I think coming out of this, really keeping the focus on the pandemic and kind of farming post-pandemic, I feel like for myself, at the beginning of when COVID first started, I was really concerned for a lot of my friends in my broader community of farmers, of just the challenges that they would face during this. And then I really kind of turned that around, and I was almost maybe upset with myself that I didn't see it sooner of, this is why we have local foods. This is why we have our local farmers, is to be resilient in these large scale challenges. And I'm wondering if you could give us an example just from your observations over the last few months of maybe somewhere where you've seen that.
Well, I'll give you an example. One of the programs, you know, precisely because of the garden paradigm, when farmers started to commit suicide and school kids started to commit suicide, I said, let's start Gardens of Hope for children in schools and for widows of the suicide. I had a call at the peak of the pandemic. And this peasant woman tells me, just thank you so much, Didi. Didi's elder sister in India. Inspiring us to grow gardens, we thought it was an extra. But during the lockdown, this is where our food came from. And the second thing that's happening is we saved seeds. And our fruits might be a little smaller, but they're full of phytochemicals. I talked about my mother's mangoes. We are now realizing that resilience is also immunity. You know, comes back to the idea of potential. The same body can have potential for sickness with lack of immunity. The same person can have resilience to infections with good immunity. People are now realizing it's not the size that matters. It's the quality and the nutrition and the phytochemicals, the diversity of nourishment that matters. So there's a whole revisit to nutritional density, amazing biodiversity of ingredients in a seed. The size, I think white superiority, just admired size. I think if you're looking, living through equality, anti-racism and decolonization, we need to stop celebrating size and start celebrating the multiplicity of smallness. When I started saving seeds to deal with Monsanto patents, GMO, WTO, I took inspiration from Gandhi's spinning wheel. He had said, a spinning wheel will get us freedom. And we did get freedom. So I said, the seed will be the spinning wheel of today. So in this period, the inspiring stories just keep, I mean, people call me from Italy and say how the CSAs have exploded and was the only way they could get food because the supermarkets shelves emptied out.
That was Vandana Shiva teaching a master class to students at the Faculty of Land and Food Systems at the University of British Columbia on August 17, 2020. On that day, she was sheltering in place on what was once her mother's farm in Doon Valley, India. It is now the site of Navdanya, a nonprofit dedicated to organic farming and seed collecting. Vandana Shiva is the author of over 20 books, including the violence of the Green Revolution, monocultures of the mind, soil not oil, and oneness versus the 1%. In the last 30 years, Vandana Shiva has campaigned against genetic engineering, biotechnology, chemical industrial agriculture, patenting of life, and the global rule of the World Trade Organization. And now here comes a so-called bonus track. In this masterclass, Vandana Shiva had mentioned the spice gardens of India, where generation on generation have grown spices in the same patch of land. And I remembered recording her in November 2003 at UC Berkeley at the Fast Food World Conference, where these gardens also came up. Vandana Shiva.
Long before the first globalization based global trade on slavery, we had genuinely free international trade. My country was among the leaders in it. India was exporting spices long before the Europeans thought they should colonize the world to control the spice trade. And of course, they landed here thinking they were coming to India. But it was only trade in spice. And I worked on those farms, the spice gardens in southern India and the Western Ghats. Each farm will only cultivate 1/10 of its land with spice gardens. The rest will be rice. And the rice is not even exported to the rest of the country. The spice gardens are supported with 10 times the area of forest, so the spice gardens became major conservation zones. And during colonialism, we had huge conflicts because the British wanted to convert those forests, they're called better lands, into timber mines. And the farmers said, no, these are the base of sustenance of these farms. These spice gardens have existed as long as history can be recorded. They have become unviable now because globalization is leading to a collapse of prices in spice gardens of the same 50% that Mexican farmers are experiencing due to dumping of grain. And I think that really is at the heart of the new globalization. The last globalization also had a free trade treaty. I'm sure most of you never heard of it. It was called the Farrukshir Farman with the Right Honorable East India Company, 1716. Exactly the same rules as NAFTA, same rules as WTO, same rules that basically say punish the local economy and reward the global predator. Change the entire system so that those who pirate and trade do well, and those who do honest business disappear. We got rid of that one through our freedom movement. We also with it drove away hunger, because hunger was a very important legacy of a system of farming that forced Indian peasants to grow indigo and did not allow them to grow food. Indian peasants had to grow during the American Revolution when cotton couldn't be supplied from here. Our farmers had to grow cotton for exports, couldn't grow food. No one did that willingly. No farmer wanted to only grow export crops. The famine that we had, 2 million people killed in 1940, led to a major rebellion, revolt, rethinking. We got freedom, we got rid of hunger. We redistributed land, and I think miraculously became the only society in the contemporary world that made the rural areas viable for 75% of our population. There is no other part of the world where 750 million people make a living in agriculture. And yet that 750 million people's livelihoods and lives are threatened because of a new trade system, which I believe is based on two totally illegitimate principles. The first is the principle of the right to dump, which is sell below the cost of production. And I agree with Michael, it's not just about subsidies. Because anyway, subsidies given to farmers to grow for the domestic market don't hurt farmers in another region. It's subsidies linked to reducing prices and then selling the product overseas under a condition where you don't have a right to prevent that kind of import because of the removal of import restrictions and all the laws on market access in the WTO agreement. So it ends up being a right to dump. Right to dump now at 50% across commodities below the cost of production. That's what free trade rules are about. And the second, I would call the right to force feed. It's the right that is being exercised through WTO rules to force Indians to stop eating food cooked with their edible oils and only eat food cooked with palm oil. I believe it was not meant to be an edible oil. Or GM soya oil. And I can't go into details in these 10 minutes of how that was achieved. Or the more recent dispute introduced against the European Union in the WTO by the United States government to say the Europeans don't have a right to say no to genetically engineered food, or now, after August, don't even have a right to regulate the GM imports with labeling, segregation, and traceability laws. These are force-feeding laws. So the combination of false prices and forced feeding, in my view, doesn't lead to free trade. It leads to forced trade. And that is the real problem with the free trade agreements. They are about forcing trade on unwilling producers and unwilling consumers. I think we need rural communities everywhere in the world. Support to local agriculture anywhere in the world needs to be strengthened. What we need to see disappear is the distortions in pricing. If we can just hang on there on the demand for just prices and just trade and keep working in all kinds of creative ways, some people in changing the trade rules, others just building local organic markets, others just celebrating food as the ultimate cultural creation of humanity, I think we are being called on to create the new world order, and it'll look very different from the present one. Thank you.
That was part of Vandana Shiva's contribution to an amazing conference at Wheeler Auditorium on the UC Berkeley campus on November 24, 2003. Fast Food World presenters were Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation, the Kentucky farmer and poet, Wendell Berry, the founder of the slow food movement, Carlo Petrini from Italy, and Michael Pollan, teacher and author of The Botany of Desire. These two segments from Vandana Shiva's work are meant to inspire a new kind of thinking about food and soil at a time when coming home to basics might bring comfort and inspiration. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glurden. Thank you for listening.